You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 313 of the Earth Station DCU! Tonight we're going to talk Batman Superman World's Finest number 9, Stargirl The Lost Children number 1, Black Adam number 6, Batman One Bad Day Mr. Freeze number 1, Catwoman number 49, Nightwing number 98, The Flash number 788, Dark Crisis Young Justice number 6, Dark Crisis Worlds Without a Justice League Batman number 1, Titans Season 4 Episode 3, Jinx, Stargirl Season 3 Episode 12, Frenemies, Chapter 12, The Last Will and Testament of Sylvester Pemberton, and DC's Legends Tomorrow, Season 7, Episode 13, Knocked Down, Knocked Up. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. DC announces Superman Lost, a 10-issue miniseries from writers Christopher Priest and artist Carlo Pagulan. Coming March 14, 2023, the series will see Clark Kent thrown into a unique set of circumstances after a Justice League mission leaves him suddenly stranded in space for 20 years.
I'm interested to see what Christopher Priest does on this, Drew. I've, for the most part, liked what he's been doing since he jumped on with DC. If I'm honest, Drew, I'm a little bit surprised he's doing Superman. Just because, not because he couldn't do it, but because his interests have clearly been in characters like Black Lightning and Question and, you know what I mean, like a little more obscure and obviously minority characters. So I'm interested to see what he's going to do with Superman.
Yeah, I'm interested in it too. The premise sounded pretty interesting, especially if he's coming home after 20 years of being gone. Everything's going to be different.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a very interesting premise, like you just mentioned. So it should be something new, right? Something that we've not read before with Superman, and those always intrigue me when you get a story that maybe some version of it's been done, but relatively unique premises. It's got me intrigued for sure.
Me too. All right, up next for DC news, Patty Jenkins. Wonder Woman 3 is not moving forward at DC Studios, with the project said to be dead in its current form.
Yeah, I think initially when this story came out, it seemed everybody sort of interpreted it as that entire Wonder Woman franchise was getting shuttered, and the next time we saw the character would be some version of a reboot. After that, it seems like it's specifically Patty Jenkins that is out. And there was another report that said that she was effectively the one that left the project because, you know, the people in charge were like, we don't like what you've done. Like this, whatever her version of Wonder Woman 3 was going to be, they were like, no. And she didn't like that, didn't agree. And so they parted ways. But it seems, Drew, as though Gal Gadot is still Wonder Woman as of now.
Right. That's the take I got from it, too. So I saw the second article on it also. So
I'm not sure this is a bad thing, if I'm being honest. There were some, you never know the whole truth, but there were some rumors of what Patty Jenkins' version of the first Wonder Woman would have looked like. And there were some questionable choices that didn't make it to the film. And then we saw there were some weird choices that did make it to the film in 1984. And I don't know, man. I don't know. She clearly can direct. I want to be clear. Like the first Wonder Woman is a great movie. There are definitely some flaws in the third act, but I love that film. But maybe writing isn't a strong suit for her. I don't know. At least not for Wonder Woman, because when she got full control, it was a noticeable dip in quality.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, I'm not saddened by this either. So we know whatever James Gunn and Peter Safran are doing, it's going to include Wonder Woman. I mean, they got to have the three main trinity in their plan. So it'd be it wouldn't be very smart for them to move forward without the Trinity.
In my opinion. This whole thing, the other thing to remember is that they're only, I put quotes around this, only on a 5-year contract. So, like, whatever their vision is, Drew's kind of got to materialize relatively quickly, right? Like, that was the thing that surprised me the most when a deal was announced with Gunn and Safran, was like, only 5? I get that clearly Warner Brothers Discovery is trying to hedge their bets, but Drew, I mean, that's, you got to get results out pretty fast for the movie industry. That's not a lot of films.
No, it's not. And I'm curious to see what their plan is.
I don't know. And I don't know that they could move on from Gal Gadot, because I don't know that you have time to.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the thing is, I keep seeing all these rumors online. I just kind of been ignoring them, because until we actually see their until they release what their actual plan is, it's all speculation at this point.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree on that. The only other thing I wanted to mention with this is that Jenkins obviously has been getting some heat for the lackluster script that she helped produce for Wonder Woman 1984. But I do want to point out, because I've been harping on this point in our podcast recently, I don't want to put it all on her. The other co-writer for that, Drew, was Geoff Johns, who, once again, the more films that we've seen he's attached to, I'm just like, I think maybe you were more part of the problem than we maybe realized. And I love him as a comic book writer, Drew, but there just like is an increasing amount of evidence that maybe he shouldn't work on films.
Yeah, at this point, I can't disagree with you.
He's credited as a writer on that. Like, it's, and I have a Drew, given where he was in the power structure when 84 was getting made, I kind of feel like he was a major writer on that with Jenkins. And so I don't know, man. I think a lot of us, when he initially was sort of made, you know, Once Upon a Time was sort of DC's version of Kevin Feige, although obviously not with the same level of power. I think a lot of people, including me, thought that was a good idea, because I mean, he's been their best writer for the last decade. Why wouldn't you put your best dude on it? And the more that we've seen the films that he's been attached to, I think there was a lot of, again, including myself, benefit of the doubt that, oh, they must just be ignoring his advice or this, because surely his story wouldn't look like that. And I don't know, man. I don't think that's the case.
All right, well, let's move on to our next bit of DC news. Ezra Miller's The Flash movie gets an earlier release date. The film will now open 1 week earlier than previously scheduled and is set to arrive in theaters on June 16th, 2023.
I am not surprised that they bumped it up, Drew. I think they want to just get this film out. I think the longer that it's out there and letting people talk about it before it comes out, just only bad things can happen, honestly.
Yeah, the other reason why I heard that they possibly bumped it up was because Indiana Jones was coming out like 2 weeks after it, and they wanted to give it another week.
I mean, and that makes sense. I'm very curious, Drew, what the film is going to... obviously, I'm very curious about the story, but we've kind of speculated that they might be using the film to soft reboot their universe, as the comics did with Flashpoint. They must. I really feel, Drew, like they must be doing that, because I can't figure out why else you would, frankly, still want to put this film out. I mean, it has just got such bad press under very justifiably around it because of Ezra. And I don't know, man. There must be something with that film that they think is too important to not put out there.
Yeah, I'm very curious about it just for that reason. All right, well, let's move on to our next bit of DC news. Director Todd Phillips reveals first look at Joker as the sequel begins production. So I was, I hadn't heard anything about this movie for a while, so I wasn't sure if it was moving forward or not, but apparently it is.
I would have been pretty surprised if this one got the axe, Drew, because it got such phenomenal reception. Did, I think, far better in the box office than they thought it was going to do. So, I mean, not only was it, relatively speaking, for a superhero film, Oscar bait, and it did get some nominations, but you know, it also was a decent financial hit too, which I don't think that they were necessarily expecting when they made it. So I'd have been pretty surprised if they had canceled this one, because this one feels like it has the potential to do even better financially, because the first one was such a sleeper hit that more people are going to want to come out and watch the second one. What's going to be interesting, though, I think, Drew, is whether they can capture that magic again a second time. I feel like everybody, including us, everybody was convinced that that film was going to flop and just be an absolute disaster. And it wasn't. Like, it was actually a great film. It's just one of those things, like, I kind of got to see it to believe it again, Drew. I know that doesn't seem fair, I guess, because they did make such a good first film, but I'm kind of still sitting here being like, I don't know, prove it.
I got to tell you, Cletus, I'm pretty pessimistic about them matching the first Joker movie, and that's unlike me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, again, this is the guy, the director before this was known primarily for making the Hangover film. So, like, to say that the Joker was kind of an out of left field success is putting it lightly. I'm with you, Drew. I'm very, very dubious that the second one's going to somehow be, you know, on the same level as that first one. If it is, that's fantastic. To be clear, I would like that. I would love to watch a sequel that is just as good. That would be phenomenal. I don't know, man. I can't help but feel like it's either going to just kind of be a disappointing retread where, you know, it's not doing anything bad, but it's also not doing anything new, or it just goes like completely off the rails and it's just a total disaster. I don't know. I'm not going to lie, Drew. I will definitely on the podcast, if it is good, I will fully admit that I was wrong. I don't know. I really don't see how this one's going to live up to the first one.
Yeah, I don't either, so we'll just have to wait and see about it. All right, up next for DC News, the Black Adam movie is coming to HBO Max December 16th. So in about a week. I was surprised it was coming to HBO Max so quick, because I feel like Warner Brothers Discovery was trying to hold off on stuff releasing to HBO Max so quickly. So,
yeah, I get that, Drew, but it's not been that recently since the film came out. I mean, it is. I don't know that you're going to milk anything else out of the box office for Black Adam at this point. Like, you're just getting like the last little droplets that aren't really financially worth it. But on the other hand, you're putting it out really close to Christmas. You might get a nice little boost in HBO Max subscriptions. Like, oh, Black Adam's coming out. Well, maybe I'll get it for a month while I'm on vacation and watch it.
That's true. You know, that's very true.
To me, the timing, where we are in the year, it makes sense. And we really aren't close enough to the release of the film for them to be worrying about stealing from the box office. Like, it's done. What it's done in the box office is basically done. So I also, Drew, and this was some of the articles that were talking about the, you know, that were reporting that Jenkins was off of Wonder Woman 3 also were speculating. Again, this is total speculation that Black Adam might be in more trouble than maybe people thought. And it wouldn't surprise me if they're putting it out on HBO Max again around a time that makes sense to try and boost subscriptions to maybe see if it does move the needle. And that might be a little litmus test for the film and beyond what they did in the box office. I don't know.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I think that film is still trying to prove itself a little bit to the powers that be.
I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people held off going and seeing the movie, waiting for it to come to HBO Max.
Yeah.
Just because it's not a Superman, it's not a Wonder Woman, it's not a Batman. You know, it's Black Adam. And
yeah,
a lot of people out there don't know who the heck Black Adam is. So,
well, and on top of that, it came out to pretty lukewarm reception too. So there wasn't exactly like a, you know, line to get bust down the theater door and get in and see it. So.
Yeah, that's true. So
I would agree with that, Drew. I do think that's the thing. And I that might be good for the film, honestly, Drew, because I really do. I'm not so sure that, you know, a sequel is guaranteed for that film. And so if it does come out and gets a nice little viewership boost to HBO Max for a month, that probably would be a good thing for that franchise.
Yeah, agreed. All right, let's move on to our last bit of DC news. The Flash will return for its final season on February 8th, 2023, with 13 episodes. There seems to be a lot of news coming out about The Flash, and I've been ignoring it all. We're gonna be watching it anyways, and honestly, I don't know. I don't really care that much.
Yeah,
I just want to go into it not knowing anything and just review it that way. So,
yeah, no, I'm totally with you. I also, Drew, if I'm being honest, the news of its release date was a bit of a relief to me because we're you know, with this, the slate of TV shows that we're reviewing for the podcast right now is what we're focused on. And I don't watch the few live shows I don't watch live anymore. Part of me wasn't sure if Flash had already started or not, and seeing that it was starting on February 8th was a relief. It was like, oh, thank God, I'm not watching it right away.
Yeah, I was happy it was a ways off, too. We're going to be wrapping up Legends tonight, and then next week, wrapping up Stargirl, and Doom Patrol's already started, so I'm excited about Doom Patrol. We'll be starting Doom Patrol in 2 weeks, so I'm excited about that.
I can't wait. I saw it came out on HBO Max this past week, and it was very hard not to watch the first episode.
So it'll be here before you know it. All right, well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
So, Brittany, Martha, tell me about your podcast.
Oh, no. It's like we're in sync, but also kind of a disaster.
We are always a disaster.
So, our podcast is fun if you want to hear two people talk about and complain about stuff that they love and also hate.
And drink.
And the show is called?
Oh. but first, let's talk nerdy.
And you can find us on the ESO Network.
Ba-ding.
See you next Tuesday.
You gotta ask yourself one question, punk.
What the hell is a cigar nerd?
Welcome to the Cigar Nerds Podcast.
It's the only show where two guys smoke cigars and talk about nerd culture.
Do you like movies, games, comics, sci-fi, pop culture, and beer?
Do you like science, nerd news, explosions for no apparent reason?
Then this is the show for you.
It's like being in a nerdy cigar shop, but for your ears.
Check us out at CigarNerdPodcast.com.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. For you.
All right, let's talk Batman, Superman, World's Finest number 9. Ratcatcher has kidnapped a clerk and plans to feed him to his rats. Batman and the Boy Thunder show up. Boy Thunder lights up the sewer, giving Batman's position away. Batman uses a sonic device to stop the charging rats. Moments later, Batman explains to David why he works in the shadows. Batman explains the difference between crime in Gotham and the crime in Metropolis. The Gulf of Guinea, off the coast of Nigeria, Superman and the Flash rescue some men who've abandoned ship due to pirates. The Teen Titans secure the oil tanker from the pirates. David is criticized by Aqualad for being too harsh, but Speedy disagrees and states, if they hit you, you hit them back harder. Donna Troy tells Robin that David is so sad and angry that it spells trouble. Robin states it's survivor's guilt. Donna points out again that David is hiding something. When one of the pirates opens fire and grazes Aqualad's arm, David loses it. Superman grabs David and takes him off to a private place to talk. Superman gives David a speech about not killing. David reveals to Superman that David's parents' death was his fault. He didn't believe the end of the world was coming, so he goofed around in their lab, hid stuff, and pulled pranks because he thought it was funny. One day he wrecked the rocket on accident, and they never had time to rebuild it before the end came. Gotham City. The Joker and the Key create a direct doorway to the bottom of Gotham River. Millions of gallons of water a second are flooding the streets of Gotham. Superman redirects the water while Batman and David rescue people. While Batman has his back to David, Joker snatches him.
Well, we definitely got an answer as to what his guilt was over the Gotham that he was from. I am still wondering, Drew, if that's the whole truth or not.
I was wondering that too, especially since Donna Troy once again pointed out that it seemed to be he was hiding something.
Yeah.
So they're really hammering that point home. So it feels to me like there's still something we don't know.
Also, Drew, if I'm being completely honest, I was a little, it's not the comic's fault, but I was a little confused when we started because I was in the mindset of the Batman versus Robin story that Mark Waid has been doing that spun out of this title. And so when it wasn't that, I was like, wait, what's going on again? I was like, oh, wait, right, okay.
I do like the version of Joker in this because it's a more old-school, goofy Joker compared to the more murderous one we've been seeing lately. And I kind of like that change.
He's definitely got some Silver Age blended into him, right? Like, he's definitely not pure Silver Age. He's definitely still a murderous guy, and there's still, you know, a lot more of an evil bent than that version, but it's fitting to the comic too, right? The comic is definitely intended to have a throwback feel to it, and so giving the Joker, you know, a little bit of a throwback feel where, I mean, he's still a murderous psychopath, right? But not maybe just the complete total grimdark version that we've gotten recently. Yeah, I like it, and it's fitting for the comic. It fits the tone of the comic well.
Yeah, I agree. And I love that the comic's including different stuff like the Teen Titans. We've seen the Doom Patrol in the past and things like that. He's including a lot of DC stuff in here, and I'm really enjoying that. We're not just staying focused just on Batman, Superman.
And that's nice. Well, that's also true to the spirit of World's Finest. It's not always been a Superman-Batman team-up. And so making it, you know, obviously it's a Superman-Batman-focused book, but, you know, having it be also a Doom Patrol team-up, like you said, or in this case, Teen Titans. Like, it, again, all of it helps really fit with, you know, the tone and the theme of what the book is trying to do.
Exactly. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Stargirl, The Lost Children, number 1. Washington, D.C., April 13th, 1942. TNT and Dynamite stop the Fox and the Crow again. 6 months ago, a retired Dynamite looks at an old newspaper with the headline, TNT Killed in Action. Today, Blue Valley, Nebraska. Courtney Whitmore has detention at school. When she gets home, Courtney finds out she's grounded for another week. Her grades are slipping and her chores are piling up. Her mother mentions that the only laundry she's done the entire month is her Stargirl costume. Pat gets home and tells Courtney that Green Arrow, some other soldiers, and himself went to Wing's grave, and he is still buried there. Wing died saving the world from Nebula Man years ago. Pat and Barbara tell Courtney she needs to take a break from hanging out with Red Arrow. When Courtney goes to her room, Red Arrow shows up at her bedroom window. Emiko has a new lead on Wing, and it has to do with TNT and Dan the Dynamite. Red Arrow tells Courtney about teenage sidekicks going missing and almost being erased from history. In April of 1942, our man's sidekick, Tick-Tock, was investigating the hijacking of a shipment of Miraclo. He tracked it to some docks where both he and the shipment disappeared. The ship's old manifest shows its course charted to somewhere in the Pacific, but there's nothing there according to every map printed or online. They're going to need a boat to follow this clue. Suddenly, a voice comes on the radio calling for Danny. The radio zaps Stargirl and Red Arrow, throwing them across the room. The old man named Dan, who once used to be Dynamite, takes a boat to the mysterious island. When he reaches it, he turns young again.
But also seems to have found himself in peril at the end, too, because he, at minimum, seems to be abducted by something, if not attacked.
Yeah, if I remember right, he just had a surprised look on his face. We weren't sure what he was looking at. Is that what am I remembering?
And then the camera, like the panel cuts away and you see screaming coming from behind the rock.
Yeah, because that's what I remembered. It didn't show us anything.
Yeah, just a heavy implication of, like I said, heavy implication of some sort of peril for him. Interesting. It definitely an interesting first issue, Drew. It's got me intrigued as to, you know, what the mystery is that Courtney and Red Arrow are going to be able to uncover. It does seem like a lot. This whole project that Johns is working on has so many moving parts. He has the ability to pull it off. He really does. I'm very curious to see how he does it, because this is this story alone, Drew, there's a lot there that you can tell that he wants to get into, right? This is not a simplistic story. He clearly is trying to world build a little at the beginning here and obviously continue into the series. It's going to be interesting to see how he does that. And again, they're going to have to be given some time to breathe, really, to be able to get their feet off the ground. And if any creator is going to be allowed to do that from DC, it's going to be Geoff Johns. But, you know, with the current maybe distaste for spending money that their ownership has, I'll be curious to see what happens with all of these books if they're not like immediate successes.
Yeah, Johns is good at the slow burn. We've seen it before, so I'm curious to see where this is going to go too. There was a lot packed in this first issue, but I don't know. I'm intrigued with it, so I'm curious to see where it goes.
I am also intrigued, Drew, but it really, like you said, I mean, it's a slow burn. This is going to have to be given time to really tell its story. And I assume that it will, again, because it's Johns, and if anybody's going to be able to get that long of a leash, it's him, but I don't know. I think if this story had come out like a year or two ago, I don't think I really would have been that concerned about it. But given that things are getting canceled pretty regularly, I don't know. I have a little bit more concern than I would normally.
Yeah, I do too. But for the most part, they've been keeping their hands out of the comics, but that can always change anytime.
Comics are a little bare bones as it is, Drew. There aren't that many ongoing titles. And I don't know that that's necessarily the wrong decision either, to be clear. I'm not saying that there should be more. But, I mean, DC is already parsed down, I think, pretty noticeably. So that's sort of the concern, right, is that they've already sort of cut down, I think, a little bit. And so if they do start to get their hands in the comics, it's not a ton for them to cut out.
That's very true. You know, I set our schedule every week, and I don't know if people have noticed, I always put the miniseries first, and then we have the ongoing titles later on in the episode. So I usually try to cover the miniseries first, and that's usually 50% or more of our content before we get to the ongoing titles. So, yeah, I've definitely noticed it when I've done our schedule. So, all right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Black Adam number 6. Washington, D.C. An armored-suited Batman is ready to battle Black Adam. Black Adam transforms back into Teth Adam. Batman and Teth Adam argue until finally Batman tells Teth he better suit up. Black Adam tries to fly away, but he can't. Batman has done something to him to even the playing field. The two battle. Batman eventually reveals that this is a training program. Black Adam kills Batman in the program. Teth Adam calls Bruce Wayne. "You dare lecture me. Teach me." Bruce asks Adam what he's talking about. Teth Adam hangs up, and Bruce just seems confused by the conversation. As Teth Adam walks away, Martian Manhunter is staring out the window at him.
I was very excited for this issue, Drew, given where the last one led off. Although it didn't, I will say the Batman confrontation felt a little out of the blue at the end of last issue, and that was certainly explained by the end of this comic that indeed it was out of the blue because it wasn't him. I liked the comic, Drew. It felt like a pretty significant deviation from the plot for a miniseries, though.
Totally agree with you. And I gotta tell you, Cletus, when I started reading this, I was confused because I would have swore at the end of last issue, Black Adam didn't have his powers. But this issue starts up and he has his powers. I'm like, what's going on? I would have swore that Batman did something to him so he couldn't say Shazam to transform. So I was very confused when I started reading this one.
Yeah, I was confused too. And they weren't in the same setting, I don't think, either, at the beginning of the comic. And obviously, the comic, to the comic's credit, Drew, while it did confuse both of us, it does explain it. as you go on, you realize that they're in a virtual reality. And you know, so anything that we saw, you know, that's what the inconsistencies were. But yeah, this is a good issue. Like, I like the fighting is whatever, but I liked the dialogue between what appeared to be Batman, but seemingly was Martian Manhunter and Teth Adam. That was really interesting. This is a 12-issue miniseries, though, and I don't know that that moved the plot at all. So, I don't know. It's one of those things, Drew, like, once the series is done, we can look back and be, you know, and kind of see maybe it has more to do with the plot than we realize. Because at the moment, it feels like a pretty big diversion.
Agreed. So, we'll have to wait and see if it ties back in, because I thought the same thing, too. I was like, what are we doing here? So it did feel like it went off the rails to me too. So we'll see how it ties back in. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week: Batman, One Bad Day, Mr. Freeze Number One. In the past, we see that Nora likes to go out and spend time with her friends, while Victor likes to stay home and work. Batman and Dick Grayson Robin, who's wearing a Damian type Robin costume, stop a murderer named Meek by luring him out with some carolers. Batman mentions that Meek is one of the irredeemable ones. Back at the Batcave, Alfred asks Master Richard what seems to be bothering him. Dick states that Batman thinks the bad guys can't change. Bruce states he does think that there is one out there that can change, Victor Freeze. Some of Batman's villains have a bad day. Some have long emergencies that end in tragedy. Bruce goes back out as Matches Malone and hangs out at a bar making buddies with the local criminal element. Matches gets a lead on Mr. Freeze. Batman and Robin set up a sting operation. Mr. Freeze is working with a woman codenamed Frostbite. Batman and Robin stop Mr. Freeze and Frostbite from robbing an armored truck. Batman and Robin make a deal with Mr. Freeze. They take him to a LexCorp lab and set him up with everything he needs to save Nora. Frustrated he can't save Nora, Freeze destroys the lab. Batman and Robin go after Freeze. They learn that Freeze likes Nora right where she is at, because they don't fight anymore. Nora is not out spending money, and Freeze doesn't sit in an empty house wondering who she is out with or when she'll be home. Freeze put her in the ice for himself because he didn't want to share her with the world. The issue ends with Bruce, Dick, and Alfred having Christmas, and at Blackgate Penitentiary, Mr. Freeze gets to go outside in the yard. He makes an angel in the snow.
Drew, this was really good. I really enjoyed this one. I thought it was such a fascinating spin on what we usually get with Mr. Freeze, which is obviously, you know, it focuses on the tragic story between him and his wife. But what I like that this one does is it sort of calls into question, are we sure that their marriage was actually happy beforehand? You know, it's always just sort of assumed, right? And this one looks at it like, well, what if it wasn't? What if he was a bad husband beforehand? What if he, you know, the character flaws that led him to becoming, you know, Mr. Freeze were present prior to her disease? It makes a ton of sense as you're reading it. And it just, I really, really liked the story. This one and the Riddler are the top two for me so far, Drew, with Two-Face being absolutely dead last.
I thought this one was pretty good, too. I thought it was interesting that Nora and Victor's relationship was kind of rocky. And I also thought it was interesting that this was pretty much Nora's bad day, not Victor's. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what I loved about the comic. It was like, no, the problems that Victor has, that, you know, the comic really raises that question. I think it's a very valid point, Drew, is that, so because his wife got sick, he suddenly turned into a villain? Well, what if he had these character flaws the whole time and they just didn't manifest because there was, you know, no reason for them to? And it just, you see how unhealthy that relationship is, how uninvolved he is in his wife's life, you know, being lost in his own books, but wanting to control what she's doing, not trusting what she's doing. It's just, I thought it was a fascinating character study on him, Drew, in a light that maybe he always, and that was the thing I liked, Drew, at the beginning of the comic, is you get Batman being, well, there's one that you could redeem, it's Victor. And I feel like that's what most people, like if you asked most people who would be the most redeemable Batman villain, I feel like a lot of people would pick him. right? Again, not everybody, but I think a lot of people would. And this, what I love is the comic even shows Batman doing it. And it's like, well, wait, are you sure about that? It was just a great premise for the comic. Really, really good.
Yes. And the other thing I like, this one had more involvement with Batman and Robin in it. And I think you kind of had to have that because they actually give him the opportunity to redeem himself, and he fails.
And what's interesting, Drew, is that at the same time, you know, completely flipping our view of what usually we kind of perceive his relationship with his wife to be, it does still give him a nice ending, right? Like, he's still a villain at the end. He's still done unforgivable things, but he did finally actually do something that his wife wanted him to do, which was change the world in a positive way with the cryogenics breakthrough. Just everything about the story was just so well told and crafted. I'm big, big fan of this one. I highly recommend people go check this comic out.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Catwoman number 49. Dario pops his head out of the trunk and into the backseat of the car to find Catwoman fighting his captives. Catwoman asks Dario to drive. Catwoman leaps onto Dario's car and stops them. When Catwoman returns to Dario's car, the duo head to Alleytown. In Alleytown, Catwoman learns from Billy that Punchline is using the Royal Flush Gang to cook and run drugs through the old Ace Chemical bottling plant. Catwoman finds her doppelganger, Eco, who's also the head of the Hasagawa mob. Catwoman informs her of Punchline's activities. Valmont shows up wondering why he is seeing two Catwomen. Selina heads back to Valmont's place for a little fun time before heading back out. Catwoman discovers Batman is in Alleytown, looking to take down Punchline. Batman states he will keep Alleytown clear and let Catwoman work. Catwoman doesn't want any of the kids involved, and that includes Nightwing. Catwoman has many allies for her big plan.
I'm glad we finally moved on from the absolutely ridiculous kidnapping plot. Logic just got checked at the door for that, Drew. I just don't understand. The rest of the comic has been so well told for the most part, and has made a lot of sense in what they're doing and the way that they're telling the story. And it's like the writers just like forgot how time works for a little bit. Dario gets kidnapped and he's somehow still in a trunk long enough for Catwoman to fly all the way back to Gotham after spending a long weekend in Italy. Oy. I am relieved, to say the least, that we've moved on from that at long last.
I am too. One thing I had a problem with, though, besides the time thing, was Dario didn't know how to drive. How is he supposed to be driving in a high-speed chase?
Yeah. I'm totally with you, Drew. Literally, no part of that entire plot made sense. There wasn't any part of that plot that was like, yeah, that works. The whole thing was stupid.
Agreed.
The other thing, obviously, much to our chagrin, we see Catwoman continuing her relationship with not Batman. But Drew, I feel like we got a little glimmer of hope that they're like, well, I still think I'm going to end up with Batman long term. I'm like, just do it already.
Yes. Reading this, it was nice to see Batman in this and them have a little talk. It felt to me like, yes, we got Catwoman and Valmont together like you asked us to, but we still have this Batman-Catwoman relationship in the background we'd rather be doing. That's what it felt like to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I'd be very curious to know what creative voice is arguing for what, Drew. Or, you know, again, is it just a DC mandate that Batman does not get married? I really wish they would change it, Drew, because, again, I know we've beaten this horse dead, but, like, they let Superman get married to Lois, and I feel like that's worked out pretty well story-wise.
Me, personally, I think it's time for Batman to move on and finally get married and be at least semi-happy. To me, it feels like it's a long time coming, and I don't think it's going to happen.
I also, the other thing, too, Drew, is that I feel like we're reaching a pretty, as close as you can get to a creative consensus amongst many writers that the relationship between Batman and Catwoman makes sense, right? And so, like, if you're getting, and so all of these stories kind of tend to want to circle back to those two. And, like, if that's what everybody's doing anyway, then, like, just do it. Just, you know, we don't get, it's not like they'd be losing something from the character, Drew, because it'd be one thing if they were still frequently playing up the Playboy Bruce Wayne angle, but we rarely see that in the comic anymore. I can't think of a story that's really focused on that, that is telling a present day Batman story.
I can't either. And it's harder to play the Playboy stuff when you don't have as much money either.
And when he's definitely supposed to be a little bit older now, you know, this is not Batman in the, you know, in his absolute prime, right? Like, I feel like the Batman that we've gotten in the last, it's like basically since Rebirth, has been slightly older, right? Which makes sense because Dick Grayson's an adult. Like, Batman can't be that young anymore.
Right. So, plus we have both Jason and Tim who are out of high school. So, yeah, you have to have an older Bruce.
Yeah, and so then the Playboy angle doesn't really work because then it's just a little slimy, right? Like, it doesn't work as well as a cover because you're like, you're a little old for this, Bruce. So, yeah, I don't know. Obviously, we're just preaching to the choir with each other on this, but I really wish we would just let it happen.
Yeah, me too. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Nightwing number 98, The Gotham Woods. Nightwing is talking to someone in a car with Dick Grayson's face, claiming to be Rick Grayson. Then the guy transforms into Nightwing with his old 80s costume. Finally, the guy reveals himself to be Nightmite, a fifth-dimensional imp who claims to be Nightwing's biggest fan. Nightwing is on an impromptu date with his girlfriend, Batgirl. Nightmite points out that they also have a tied-up mob boss. When Nightmite mentions Starfire, Batgirl's smile turns to a frown. Nightmite quickly decides they need to progress their relationship, and suddenly, they are at their wedding. Even Batman is in attendance. Batman is less than thrilled to be interrupted by the imp. He was working on a triple homicide. Nightmite sends him back. Nightmite takes Nightwing back to Bloodhaven, and the real reason he is here. Blockbuster sold his daughter's soul to Neron, and he's sending his demons to collect. Nightmite powers up Nightwing's Eskrima sticks so he can fight the demons, and then turns Bitewing into a talking dog. Nightwing saves Olivia and gets Raven's help to hide Olivia from Neron. Nightmite reveals his real name to be Dixel and tells him that Nightwing is awesome.
Drew, I love that the running joke when other people keep popping up because of Nightmite, that they're like, oh, you've developed an imp. I love that running gag. But what was... I thought a great touch to the story that felt very Nightwing is that even his imp is wholesome, right? Like, even his imp is not the level of troublemaker that the other one, like Batmite or Mr. Mixie, right? Like, he is relatively helpful, right? He's a little mischievous, but not nearly at the level of the other guys.
I don't like that for a change. We didn't need to have the same old, same old.
I totally agree with you, Drew. It was refreshing in that it was a little bit different from what we've seen, but also felt, again, it felt very true to Nightwing, that, like, if an imp were to develop an obsession for him, that he would naturally be a little bit more lighthearted and be a little less of a pain in the butt than some of the other guys.
So, yeah, I liked the story. I thought it was kind of fun, and I'm sure we're going to see Nightmite again in sometime in the future. I really like the character. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, The Flash, number 788. Mayor Wolf makes a deal with the Rogues. They work for him as deputies, and they will remain free. Dr. Midnight and Mr. Terrific confirm that Linda is pregnant. They are not sure if the baby is giving Linda speed, but they tell her to go easy on her powers. Dr. Midnight wants Linda back weekly for checkups. Wally sees Captain Cold robbing a jewelry store and tries to stop him. Wally laughs hysterically when Captain Cold shows him his police badge. The other Rogues show up and try to arrest the Flash. Linda saves Flash and they both hightail it out of there. Mayor Wolf asks Blacksmith to set up checkpoints to stop and question anyone that looks suspicious. When Blacksmith asks about repaying the loans they took from the mob, Mayor Wolf tells her to cut ties. When Blacksmith continues to argue, Mayor Wolf uses meta powers on her. Mayor Wolf tells her to do what he says or she can go back to jail. The Flash visits Mick at his apartment to find out what is going on with Mayor Wolf. Flash finds out that Mayor Wolf somehow healed Mick from his illness and then offered him a job working as a deputy. Mick attacks Flash, shooting him out the window. When Flash makes it to the ground, the other rogues are waiting for him. It was a trap. Suddenly, Flash hears a tune and the Pied Piper has come to help him. I thought this ended weird, Cletus, because I thought it should have ended with the Flash caught by the rogues, not the Pied Piper coming to save him. I felt like it was left less than a cliffhanger with the Pied Piper saving him at the end.
I guess. I don't know. Would you really have been on the edge of your seat, Drew?
No, but...
If it had ended a panel sooner?
No, I point taken.
I think that's the thing. I think the real answer is, if you're already reading the comic, you're going to read the next one. But in theory, what's more likely to get you to come back and read the next one? Whether Flash is going to be okay? No. Or, Pied Piper is in this? Far more likely to bring a reader back. Again, the real answer is the readers that are reading this are going to come back regardless, but I thought this was fine. I am intrigued by the idea of deputized rogues. I feel like we've seen something similar to that before, maybe in like alternate timelines or whatever. I guess my one question, Drew, is it feels like the mayor is acting with an awful lot of impunity and pretty open. At this, like, deputizing the rogues seems like a pretty openly brazen move. I don't know. I guess I don't know that the comic's done enough to convince me how literally not everybody has figured out what he's up to.
To me, it felt like Mayor Wolf was acting like a dictator. I mean...
He's just a mayor. He's an American mayor.
Yes.
That's what I don't understand, Drew. Like, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't make his actions reflect, like... He somehow is able to do whatever he wants without question. I'm like, the dude literally just got elected. Hey, how? I feel like the election just sort of happened like that. And nobody has any questions about this. They're all just like, oh, he's mayor. I guess that's how mayors work.
I mean, if he would have deputized the rogues, there would be backlash for the public. You set up checkpoints for, people to be stopped and questioned. There's going to be pushback from the public. It doesn't feel like this would happen.
I agree.
All right, that's all I got to say about that. Yep. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Dark Crisis Young Justice number 6. Happy Harbor, Rhode Island. Mixie Pillalick has decided that since Young Justice won't accept his new world, he will become the villain. Impulse lends Cassie some of his speed to slow down time. Impulse has a plan, but Cassie needs to distract Mickey. Cassie makes Mickey angry, so he takes away Young Justice's power. Except for Impulse, because Mickey does not believe he's a threat. Cassie tricks Mickey into giving them their powers back. Impulse springs the trap he hid in the Speed Force. It is an atom split in two, responding to itself like an echo chamber. With the help of all the Young Justice members, Impulse traps Mickey there, kind of like the Phantom Zone, but more finite. Young Justice hurries back to the Hall of Justice to join the fight with the other heroes. To be concluded in Dark Crisis on Infinite Earths.
It's over.
Thank God. I know, at first I was kind of excited about Young Justice, and then we started reading it. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse.
It was not a good comic. It was so on the nose with what it was trying to do too, and it was just like, I get what your point is. Can you focus on telling the story? Boy.
Which wasn't even a good story.
No, God no.
All right, let's move on to our last title for this week. Dark Crisis, Worlds Without a Justice League, Batman number 1. The last city on Earth. Mr. Wax learns that there is another incident by the Knight during downtime. Mr. Wax watches the video, but there is no audio. The Knight catches Oswald Cobblepot, who states he was hired to move this tech. The Knight states he hunted Oswald for many years because he has a DNA match that Oswald killed his parents, Martha and Thomas Wayne. Oswald denies it, but the Knight kills him. We learn that there is a plague of madness. a psychic virus so destructive the weight of the shattered minds literally broke reality. A machine was built to secure an island of sanity by Mr. Wax. The Knight kidnaps Mr. Wax and brings him back to his cave. The Knight used equipment to analyze his brain and find anomalies. The Knight scanned the city, seeking patterns and coincidence, and found a match. Both Mr. Wax and the Knight have the same face. One of them is a fake. The equipment that the Knight seized emits a signal. The signal is coming from the Madlands on the outskirts of the old city limits. The two masked men, one in black and the other in white, enter the house to discover Alfred. Alfred explains that this lab used to belong to Jonathan Crane, who did experiments on patients, until one day he brought in inmate 3141, a killer whose unique psyche overloaded Crane's machines and created a psychic virus so strong it overthrew an entire world. Alfred explains that Bruce Wayne was copied so perfectly that there was no difference between the two except their psyches. Both happy as they are, one dark and one light. It isn't effective if both know about it. Alfred erases their memories and then sets another villain free. This is the 53rd time Alfred has reset them. The other story we had was a Xantana story. Xantana tries to use magic to reshape her world until the Justice League comes along and frees her. To be continued in Dark Crisis on Infinite Earths, number 7. I don't know about you, Cletus, but I found this disappointing. I thought the premise of splitting Bruce Wayne into a good half and a bad half is a good idea for a story. This did not feel like Bruce Wayne, Batman's ideal world to me.
I think that's fair, Drew. I would agree with that, but I would go, I thought this one was on the same level as the Superman one that we read that I really liked by Tom King. And I would argue you could say the same thing about that Superman world, Drew. Are you really sure that that's what Superman would want? Those two stories feel like really good alternate, you know, a world without Justice League story, but they don't make, neither of them make sense in terms of this is the dream world given to them by Pariah.
Yeah.
Definitely. I completely agree with you. It does not make sense as the world that Batman would secretly desire. I fully agree. I really liked it as an alt world Batman story, though. That was a very intriguing idea of having two halves of Bruce Wayne, and they can't help but find each other because that's who they are. Like, they inevitably are going to figure the secret out. This one and the Superman one, Drew, were both so interesting. I wish we could have gotten like a 3-issue miniseries with them because you could have gotten more story out of them, because both of them felt like you could have done more with.
Yes. I thought the story needed to be fleshed out more, honestly. It was too compact, too quick. Yeah. And I think it needed more time to breathe. I thought it was a pretty good premise. I just thought it was rushed, and I found it really interesting, though. And the fact that it's the 53rd time that Alfred reset him was not surprising. The Xantana backup story was not that good.
That's putting it lightly. It existed. There was, man, Drew, I feel like we've gotten some of the, like, that's not the only one that we got that was sort of, I think the Hawk Girl one was just as bad, where they were just like, they existed as sort of like, oh yeah, those characters we need to do something for too. Let's just throw them in real quick, which is not great that they did that with two of the female members of the Justice League, but it is what it is.
Question for you, because I do not remember this. Was Xantana with the Justice League when they went out against Pariah?
Yeah, I think she was. Oh, I don't remember definitively, but I'm pretty sure she was.
Okay, I didn't remember that. So, all right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our DC television shows.
Comic-Cons are back, and fans are ready. Hear all about it on The Con Guy Show, where we keep you up to date on all the events, the movies, the people, and the conventions that drive your passions and feed your fandom. Straight from the nerdy heart of Hollywood, California, we are proud members of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
You know what now is a good time for? It's time for a promo for the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
The Cosmic Pizza Podcast, you say?
That sounds delicious. What is that?
It's a delicious slice of life.
In every episode?
In every episode, where we talk about conspiracy theories,
cartoons of our childhood,
Star Trek quizzes,
movies that we've liked,
pod racing, general pop culture,
fantasy recasts.
But what we don't talk about is pizzas.
Right here on the ESO Network.
And we're back. Let's talk Titans, Season 4, Episode 3, Jinx. Raven is okay after the attack last episode, but her soul self is gone. Tim goes back to Star Labs to start his training as Robin. He's going to learn how to use his bow staff. Sebastian gets a call from Derek Sands at Bixel. His team has reconsidered and decided to buy his game, except it's not really Derek who called, but the woman who attacked the Titans, imitating his voice. Dick and Corey go to prison to visit an inmate named Jinx, who runs in the magic circles. Dick thinks she can help with Raven. Jinx escapes when her foot touches the ground. Dick has a guess to where she is going. When Dick and Corey catch up with her, she is trying to steal an object. It turns out to be the heart of a dark elf, and it turns Corey into stone. Gar makes Raven pancakes. He hears voices again and goes outside. Gar tells Raven that he has been getting flashes of a weird place, a world surrounded by red, voices calling him Skinwalker, and telling him to join them. In Navajo culture, Skinwalkers are shapeshifters that can change into animals. Gar believes they are trying to tell him something about the woman that attacked them. Tim is training with Bernard and Connor at Star Labs. Bernard gets a notification that there was a break-in at MPD Evidence Warehouse and two people are dead. 40 gallons of blood were stolen. Sebastian goes to see Derek. Derek tells him he never called Sebastian. Suddenly there is chanting and Derek kills himself with a pair of scissors. Everyone thinks Sebastian killed Derek. Bernard runs a blood analysis and learns that each victim has a genetic mutation that traces its origin back to an ancient Assyrian tribe. Connor traces the symbol from the blood containers back to a video game that a guy named Sebastian Singer uploaded online. Dick and Jinx go to a secret bar where Dick meets with the dark elf. Dick will return the heart in exchange for his friend being released from the spell. Instead, the dark elf tries to kill Dick. Not only does Dick beat her men, but Dick also defeats the dark elf in hand-to-hand combat. Dick figures out that Jinx has a death mark. She owes a $5 million debt. Dick puts $5 million in escrow, and if Jinx helps the Titans with their magic problem, then Jinx will get that money. The witch meets Sebastian in lockup and tells him that she is going to help change the world. She can help all this go away if he repeats these words. Azareth, Metreon, Xenthos. Superboy shows up before he can finish saying the words and takes Sebastian. Gar and Raven are in the red world and find the tree that Gar saw in his vision. Hanging from its branches are trophies, collected and slaughtered by a dark force. They tell Gar that when the blood moon is full, the world will follow you.
Another really interesting episode, Drew. The only thing I will say, I like that Jinx is joining the cast for this season. And I get maybe not having her just immediately join the team or whatever, but I did feel like the sidetrack adventure that she goes on with Dick was very sidetracky. Like, we went really off the beaten path to do that.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I felt the same way when I watched the episode. I was like, why are we going off on this weird... I know they did it to introduce the character, give us a little bit of her background, personality, her history with Dick, but it did feel like it sidetracked the direction of the show on this.
It was such a focus of the episode, too, was the problem. Like, the main story that they're trying to tell is so intriguing, Drew, and so interesting, and they took a ton of time to tell a story that was fine. To be clear, it was fine. There wasn't anything wrong with what they were doing, but it wasn't that interesting, right? Like, I didn't need to get 30 minutes of them delivering a heart to an elf that has absolutely no bearing whatsoever on the story.
She didn't even get the heart, though. Dick ends up beating up her men and her and leaving with it because he figured out Jinx had the power all along. It was basically, it felt like a waste of our time.
Yeah, I mean, it was. Again, they introduced the character, but I feel like they could have done that while still, they could have had maybe the Titans chasing after her. You know what I mean? Like, they found her basically immediately, right? And it would have been maybe more interesting if it was just a cat and mouse episode where they slowly track her down and get her to join them. That would have, you know what I mean? Because then it feels like it's part of the story. I don't know. I feel like there was a better way to do it. But I do like her character. And I am so, so intrigued by the Brother Blood storyline. I just wish that it wasn't so in the background so far.
I agree with you. It's really interesting. And Sebastian becoming Brother Blood, we're seeing a slow burn with that. It doesn't feel like it's going to happen for a few episodes. Because they basically stopped the witch before she got him to say the words he needed to, which I'm sure was some sort of spell. I also thought the storyline with Gar and Raven was interesting. So we finally got to see more of that.
I agree. Definitely seemed to be tying into the Red. I don't think they would, Drew, but man, it'd be really interesting if they threw Animal Man in there. That's all I'm saying. Seems like he could be relevant to the story.
That'd be cool, but I don't think that's going to happen.
I agree. I'm just saying it could. They could. It would not feel out of the blue.
I like the fact that they came out and said that Tim is going to be the next Robin. They finally said what they're going to do with him. And not surprising that he went back to Star Labs to train with Bernard. Though it does feel like Dick should probably be the one training him, but... Still, you know, even with the sidetrack part of the story, this was still a pretty good episode. And I'm anxious to get back to a more focused episode.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Stargirl, Season 3, Episode 12, Frenemies, Chapter 12, The Last Will and Testament of Sylvester Pemberton. Sylvester checks on Artemis at her parents' gym and learns that she wants to kill Jordan McKent. Sylvester tells Artemis that there was a future that her parents wanted for her, and it's not prison. The best way for Artemis to honor her parents is to go to college and be the star that they raised her to be. Sylvester is going to kill Jordan McKent for Artemis. Rick tries taking off the hourglass and goes through some sort of withdrawal. Rick puts the hourglass back on. Beth tries calling Rick, but gets no answer. Jordan McKent tells Cameron that he's going after the ultra-humanite himself and bringing him in to prove his good intentions. Sylvester tells Pat that he distracted him during the most important fight against the ISA and got him killed. Pat is no hero. Not then and not now. Pat is just a sidekick. Courtney overhears Pat and Sylvester fighting. Courtney tells Starman that at one time she thought he was her hero, but in truth it has been Pat Dugan. He's been there for her. And she thanks God every day that Pat is her father. Sylvester tells Courtney he needs the staff. Courtney tells him that she's not giving it to him. Sylvester takes the staff anyways. Sylvester tells Courtney that she may have swayed the staff to herself before, but deep down she knows it belongs to him. Sylvester tells Courtney that she is not worthy of the staff. Jakeem wishes the Thunderbolt will take Cindy, Mike, and himself to the lab that has the answers that Cindy needs. The trio learn that Dr. Ido has put his brain in Ultra-Humanite's body. Pat goes to the McKent house to back up Starman. Starman and Pat make up and then start searching the house for Icicle. Starman takes out Pat while he has his back turned. Pat wakes up in a grave and realizes Starman is actually the ultra-humanite who buries Pat alive. Cletus, what a great twist. I thought the other episode where they revealed that Icicle was still alive was a great twist. Starman being actually the ultra-humanite this whole time was not expecting it whatsoever. But it makes sense.
I thought it was a great twist too, Drew. And I thought the show did a really good job trying to, or I guess I should say, the show did address the potential confusion and maybe irregularities with that twist. Being like, well, wait, some of these scenes don't make sense if they're not Sylvester, if they're really ultra-humanite, and they try to explain, well, you know, he gets really into the role. The only thing I will say, Drew, I gotta see how they resolve this plot next episode, because I appreciate that the show really did try to answer that question. Be like, hey, look, some of this stuff might not make sense for Ultra Humanite to have done, but if you think about, like, he's trying to blend in as the character and he kind of tends to get lost in the character that he's playing, this sort of makes sense. You're like, okay, some of that makes sense. But then you got the scene where Pat, by all appearances, Drew, Pat almost tricks him into letting him go by appealing to the Sylvester character that apparently does not, like, again, is purely a character that Ultra Humanite is putting on. And that doesn't make sense. Because I don't think they're playing at, like, there's some vestige of Sylvester left in his body, but that can't be. The brain's not there. The show's own answer is that the Ultra Humanite gets so lost in the people that he's playing that he, like, forgets that he's not them and just becomes them. And that's, so I'm sorry, Drew, but that's silly.
I'm not going to argue with you on that because I agree with you. I thought that was a little, I have to agree with you. That scene in the grave where Pat almost tricks him didn't make sense, really.
The twist as a whole, I like. To be clear, I'm with you, Drew. I loved the twist. It was like, because it answered a lot of questions about the weird irrationality that we'd seen throughout the season from Sylvester and some of the decision-making that I repeatedly brought up. I was like, how is a seasoned hero making these mistakes? I thought that it answered a lot of that. But then when it also was like, yeah, but sometimes he just forgets and thinks he really is Sylvester. I'm like, well, that's stupid, though.
Yeah, agreed. But I really like that twist, though. I was not expecting it. And I like twists when I'm not expecting them. Did not see that coming.
Yeah, I didn't either, because it felt like it was setting up. I thought that the twist, so to speak, was going to be that Sylvester was going to die again. And I think that's what the show wanted you to think. They were all setting it up for, and even the title of the episode is making it sound like, you know, he's going to go and get killed by Icicle a second time. And then obviously we get the rug pulled out from under us. Very interesting. Very, very interesting. I am curious to see how the last episode goes. I maintain that this absolutely does not make sense as a wrap up to the series as a whole, but that's what Jeff John says.
We'll see, huh? All right. Well, let's move on to our last episode. And the series finale of DC Legends Tomorrow, Season 7, Episode 13, Knocked Down, Knocked Up. Gary was ejected from the airlock at the end of last episode, but he is still alive. Gary lands at an unknown location in 30,000 BC. Week 1. The Legends show up at Constantine's mansion for their weekly dinner, but Gwen and Alan are missing. The Legends notice the time machine is missing and instead find a note that reads, "Thank you, dear Legends. Without you, I would have never found the courage to find my one true love, Gwen." France, 1916. Gwen plans to replace the real Alan with Robo-Alan on the battlefield. Evil Gideon tells Gideon that she has detected an anomaly. It's the Constitutional Convention of 1787. A time traveler is posing as one of the framers trying to change women's rights. Gideon fixes the problem. Week 4 comes and goes without incident for the Legends. Week 6, Sarah cuts herself and doesn't immediately heal. In 30,000 BC, Gary has created a door and travels back to the mansion. Gary informs the Legends that Evil Gideon tried to kill him because he found out that Evil Gideon sent Gwen home with a robot. The Legends learn that Gwen was killed by the Fixer. Zari has a time courier and they decide they have to go save Gwen. Gary tells Sarah that she is pregnant. Something must have triggered her to ovulate. Sarah is a half Cribilix and by nature nesters, which is what Ava and her were doing. All it takes for the egg to drop is just a mere thought of a baby. After that, all you need is your partner's DNA to fertilize it. France, 1916. The Legends run into human Gideon, who catches her up on everything. Gideon returns to the Wave Rider upset. Evil Gideon offers to turn her into Robo Gideon to save her from the pain of her feelings. Astra and Spooner save Gideon before she becomes Robo Gideon. When human Gideon decides to reset Gideon to Rip Hunter's original protocol, Evil Gideon downloads herself into Robo Gideon. The Legends run into Gwen, who realizes he must have died during his first attempt. The Legends leave a note on their hands to talk to the Fixer, Mike. The Legends convince Mike that they need his help because the fixed point is trying to fix itself. Robo Gideon goes after Human Gideon, Astra, and Spooner. Human Gideon reveals the Wayrider to the World One soldiers, and Evil Gideon becomes the anomaly. Evil Gideon destroys herself and the Wayrider. Astra uses her magic to put the Wayrider back together. Instead of helping the Legends, Mike steals the Wayrider and destroys Gwen's time machine, stranding the Legends. Nate saves Alan, but mustard gas has corroded his steel exterior. Zari gives Nate her totem, since he will be living with the other Zari and the ancestors. The Legends say their goodbyes to Nate. The Wayrider returns. The Legends board, but it's a trap. Mike, or Booster Gold, is under arrest, and so are the Legends, for crimes against time.
Drew, I'm so relieved it's over. I'm not even upset that we don't see more of Booster Gold.
I thought it was great, the actor they played to pick Booster Gold, because he's a comedian, and I think he would have fit. He seemed to fit Booster Gold's personality.
I agree. No, I think Donald Faison was a great choice for Booster Gold. I totally agree with you there, Drew. And the little bit that we got with him, it's obviously not exactly the Booster that we've seen. Like, Skeets isn't there. Again, obviously there are some changes, but he felt like Booster, right? Like, he's golfing through the trenches, that, you know, stealing the time ship. All of that felt like things that Booster would do. So Donald Faison, I had no problem with. That was about the only, he was really the only thing I enjoyed in the episode, if I'm being honest.
I have to agree with you, because this episode was a mess. It was sloppy. Alan's death is a fixed point in time, and we're going to put a fixer there? Thought that was ridiculous.
Well, it seems to be a fixed point because it's the impetus of what causes the Doctor to become, to invent time travel.
Okay, I guess that does right, make like, kind of sense.
Because he dies, Gwen is so upset by it and invents time, invents time travel to try to undo it. Obviously, in the real timeline, he's supposed to be unsuccessful. So that sort of made sense. But then the show itself brings up the point that that would be a stupid thing for any time traveler to undo, because if you did, you'd undo yourself. No time travel would exist. Drew, I just have so many, there were so many dumb, like you said, sloppy things in this episode. They, in an ideal world, right, this was just supposed to be a season finale, and then there was going to be another season next year. And yet we got a scene writing Nate off in the most offhanded and mind-numbing way, where I'm sorry, lad, you've used up all of your steel. That, it's a resource? He's got a pool of steel underneath, Drew, that he pulls from, and the mustard gas just tapped out the tank?
Yeah, that was stupid.
That's the thing. Like, again, it's a series finale, unintentionally a series finale. So it ultimately doesn't matter, but think about it from the lens of what the show, this episode, was created as. As a season finale, what an atrocious write-off for his character.
Agreed.
They're just sort of like, he got mustard gas, and now he's just going to go write a book. He's off the show now. What? What a brutal way to write that character off. The Sarah pregnancy was silly, I guess. So you could go like, you could view it with the typical silly Legends thing, but it was also, like, frankly, pretty dumb, right? Like, their explanation for it was like, well, that doesn't really make sense, but we just want two female characters to have a baby without any of the usual methods for that to happen. So we're just going to rub our hands together magically, and they're going to have a baby now. You know what? They just found like the most convenient way possible to hand wave and be like, well, what if they were both biologically the parents? Like, okay, I guess. It's silly, but okay. But then my biggest problem, Drew, is the problem I've had this entire season, that I don't remember this show having this problem beforehand, which is where, for whatever reason, the writer's room clearly had some sort of existential crisis and was like, well, wait, what would be the downside of protecting the timeline? And this whole season has been focused on that idea of, like, if you truly protect and preserve the timeline, you are preserving bad along with the good, right? And they're getting into the morality of that. And again, Drew, I want to point out, they're not necessarily wrong. Like, there is some questionable morality to preserving some of the great atrocities that have happened throughout history. But the whole point, and I feel like not just this show, but time travel stories across like everything that we've seen, the whole idea is that even if you are making a change for good, you don't know what other changes that's going to cause. That yes, maybe you do something benevolent in the moment, but what does that cause in the future? You don't know. You don't know that the thing that you're doing that is maybe in the moment objectively good is going to cause something worse in the future. And maybe it doesn't, but you don't know. You are fundamentally changing the course of time, and the world is not going to play out in the same way that it did. Is that morally better? I don't know. I don't know. The show never really looks at that part, Drew. That's sort of my problem, is that the show looks at the first half and it's like, well, this thing is bad. And so time travelers have a moral responsibility to make that bad thing not happen. And you say, okay, well, then what? What happens after you change that? And the show has not, it never bothers to answer that question, Drew. The show, seemingly the answer the show wants you to accept is, we changed the bad thing and the world went exactly as it was supposed to anyway. Which makes no sense.
No, it doesn't. And the thing with time travel is, you change one minute thing could have drastic change to the future.
And that's the whole point of, again, the whole idea of preserving the timeline is that you preserve it the way it is, because yes, there are bad things, but there are also good things that come later down the line, that if you change this thing, maybe that good thing later doesn't happen. Or if you move the timetable up and make the good thing happen 100 years earlier, who knows what happens after that? Maybe, yes, Drew, maybe. I think, again, the show is like, well, if we just made all of the good things happen, if we just applied 2022 morals to 1000 BC, then the world would be a utopia, because as we all know, we currently live in a utopia in 2022. So you know what, but that's that's fundamentally the problem I have, is that the show is asking, I think, a legitimate moral question, but doesn't want to actually deal with it. It only just wants to be like, well, this thing is bad, and because we're a time travel show, we're going to focus on the bad thing and fix it without any regard to what that would do time-wise. I think one of the reasons why the show avoided that problem up until this point, Drew, is that they technically were always preserving the timeline, right? In theory, we were told that's what they were doing, but often what they were doing was, it was like time aberrations, like Genghis Khan would pop up in the year 2020 and he's not supposed to be there. And so you take him and plop him back where he goes. Right. That was how they were patrolling the timeline. It was like things that were popping up that weren't supposed to happen. They, you know, weren't supposed to be there. They go back and fix that. Right. And that makes sense. And it sort of washes your hands, because all you're doing is making sure that like dinosaurs aren't in the medieval period. But they also have to make sure that Joan of Arc is executed, you know, in France in the medieval time, because if she's not, then the timeline changes and you have to be like, well, does she deserve to be executed? I don't think she does. It behooves us to make sure that she's alive. And now all of a sudden, now we're deciding what time is and who lives and who dies. Drew, I feel like the show really thought that they were on their moral high pedestal, and they feel like they were ignoring a lot of other questions that go alongside that.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. All right, well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, so I was excited to see Jinx was in Titans. I will admit, Drew, I think I've only ever seen her in the animated Teen Titans series. I don't know that I've ever read a comic that she's in. Not to say that she's that obscure, I don't think I've ever read it. And so I wanted to look up, you know, the actual comic book Jinx and not the animated one that I'm familiar with. A much different looking character, first off. I feel like the show is actually relatively accurate from what I've seen in some of the artwork I've pulled up. Obviously way, way different from the white and pink character that is in the cartoon. But the character first pops up in Tales of the Teen Titans number 56, which came out in 1985, and she is part of the Fearsome Five. And really, she kind of pops up right at the end. She gets rescued by some of the other members of the Fearsome Five. Kind of interesting, Drew. Like I said, like, I'm very familiar with the animated version of that character, as I think a lot of people my age are. But I had no knowledge of the actual comic book version of her.
I've seen her before, and honestly, I couldn't remember where I've seen her before. So, I mean, it's possible it was during the Titans cartoon. I don't remember her from the cartoon, but I feel like I've read her in the comics somewhere before, and I just couldn't remember, so hard telling. All right, and for my shout out, I'm going to shout out about the podcast, but first, Let's Talk Nerdy, episode 78. Let's talk about the hot mess that is the Bat Fam. That's one of the podcasts on the network. This is the first time I've listened to their podcast. I was intrigued because they were talking about the Bat Family. So Martha reviews Batman, Battle for the Cow. And then Brittany talks about all the pets that who have joined the Bat Family over the years. So I checked out their podcast and found it interesting, funny. So get a chance, I suggest you check it out. I was just interested in what they were having to say about the Bat Family. So, and honestly, Batman Battle for the Cow, I was not reading comics at that time. That was when I was on hiatus from comics. I'm pretty sure that's probably when you were reading, wasn't it, Cletus?
I didn't read that specific comic, but I was reading that era of comics, because that's right around the Grant Morrison time. I'm almost positive he didn't write Battle for the Cow, but he is writing the Batman book around that series.
I'm pretty sure that was written by Tony S. Daniel, but don't quote me on that without looking it up.
That sounds right. He at least drew it. I don't remember if he was the writer, but I'm pretty sure he was at least the artist.
You're looking it up, aren't you?
No.
Okay.
That was a pretty big... That comic spins out of the events of Final Crisis, written by Grant Morrison. And then coming off of the Battle for the Cow, Grant Morrison's Batman and Robin, pretty iconic run with Dick as Batman and Damian as Robin, started after that series. So it's an interesting point in that sort of late 2000s era of DC, right? Like, not that long before the New 52.
So one of the other things that Brittany talked about was, she brought up Ace the Bat Hound's origin, where he came from, and then his post-crisis appearance, which I have that comic. So when she started talking about the post-crisis Ace being brought back, I was like, oh yeah, I remember that. I have that comic. So that was just interesting to hear about. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got The Human Target, Batman Fortress, Tim Drake Robin, Action Comics, Detective Comics, Dark Crisis, The Dark Army, and our DC television shows, Titans and the series finale of Stargirl. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Wonder Woman! Wonder Woman!
All the world is waiting for you, and the power you possess. In your satin tights, fighting for your rights, and the old red, white, and blue.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.